Second Chronicles, the 16th chapter, and I am mindful of the clock back there, and we'll keep a diligent eye on that, and I am mindful that this is Mother's Day, and I am mindful of my tradition for many years of making sure that I cut it short on Mother's Day and on Father's Day, and I will be mindful of that. At that time, verse 7, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said unto him, Because thou hast relied on the king of Syria and not relied on the Lord thy God, therefore is the host of the king of Syria escaped out of thine hand. Were not the Ethiopians and the Lubims a huge host with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because thou didst rely on the Lord, he delivered them into thine hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him. And I just want to remind us all of that today. God is who God is. We understand those three attributes that must come to characterize God if indeed he is to be God, and that is his omnipotence, his omniscience, and his omnipresence. And God is certainly all three of those things. But you can know those three things about God and miss the most important thing about him if you're not looking into his word. That is that God cares about us. The scriptures tell us that he loves us. And that he loved us to the extent, John 3:16, Jesus said that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but should have everlasting life. What if he didn't care? What would all that power and all that eternal presence and all that divine knowledge, what would that mean to any of us if God was simply who the deists among us claim him to be? And that's a creator who does not care about his creation. But he's not. He cares. And on this Mother's Day, I'm reminding all of us of that. Well, moms, how are you doing? And dads, how are you doing? You know, when Father's Day rolls around, it's not hard to please your dad. I mean, just if he's still hanging around this world somewhere, it doesn't take much. I mean, if he likes to fish, get him a fishing lure. And he'll brag on it and be thankful that you got it for him. If he likes to golf, get him a new golf club or get him a dozen new golf balls that don't have those dimples all in them, the smileys where he hacked and whacked it. He'll be happy to have those new golf balls. If he's into tools and doing some work around the house, and get him a gift certificate to Home Depot or Jaeger's or... As guys, it doesn't take much. You know, just get us a toy. Get us something to distract us for a little while from things that burden our life, and we'll be just as tickled as we can be. I never wondered much about what to get Daddy for Father's Day. I did wonder a great deal about what to get Mama and what to get Donna. She is certainly not my mother, but I don't want to let that day pass as if I didn't know that she is the mother of our children. And we're just not good, guys, at figuring out exactly what they want. I mean, we try, you know. We bring them something sometime in bed on Sunday morning when Mother's Day rolls around, maybe. Or we take them out for lunch after Mother's Day and spare her a day of cooking, I guess. We do that. Flowers, you know. We can handle stopping by the florist or making a phone call for a delivery. But that's about the best we can do. And she acts like she's thrilled and happy and just couldn't be more pleased with what it is that we've gotten her. And that's good of her to do that. But they did the poll, which they always do in polls, right? And they did it, and the results came out yesterday about Mother's Day weekend and what you really want. And in case you mothers here didn't know exactly what you wanted, I'll tell you what you really want. What you really want is not what your husbands or children are getting you. Those things like the meal, you know, and the flowers, that out of the list of things that people were polled on, that fell way down yonder on the list. What received a little over 70% of positive response from the mothers who were polled? A day at the spa, you know. Get them some time to themselves away from those kids and away from you guys. And let her sit among other people who will pamper her for a while, over 70%. I did that for Donna before the poll came out. For several years, I would get her a gift certificate, 150 or something like that, to a spa there around locally, and she'd go and be pampered for a few hours, and No, I thought I had this Mother's Day thing figured out, and I was in good shape, because that's easy to do. You stop by and you get a gift certificate and get a card, and you're in good shape. But about 3 years ago, she said, I think you've done enough of that. I don't know what there is about her that she didn't like to fit in with the mainstream, but so I haven't done any spa treatments for 3 years now, and I won't do another one until she tells me, I've been missing those things. Why don't you get back to that? And that's when I'll get back to it. Well, if you're a young mother, you're still collecting cards. The kinds that your kids do for you, if they're in school, the teacher has them do them to honor Mother's Day. And so they got these little red hearts cut out on drawing, or crayon cards, construction paper, and you're tickled to death with those, and you keep them in a special file locked away somewhere. Maybe your children of the age where now they go to the card store and get the very best Hallmark card that has the prettiest scenery and has the very best that our poets can do to write a tribute to your mother and all that mother means to you. And all of that stuff that we do simply to say to our moms, what I hope we say to our moms: we love you and we value what you do and what you bring into our lives. Especially Christian mothers. All mothers, but especially Christian mothers. It's like a lot of other things. Sainthood doesn't come with being a father, and sainthood doesn't come with being a mother. During the years of experience that I had in the public school system, one thing that always disappointed me that we had to deal with on way too regular a basis was the dad was gone from the home. I mean, he was flown to Timbuktu and had been from the time the kid was little. And the mother might as well have been. The child would be better off if she had been. Because those situations would arise where, in dealing with the mother of this child, it was obvious that something was amiss. A mother that does not love her child. It's unthinkable. But it is a reality. I mean, that's there. Some children do not have memories of a good mom. But I hope all of you here this morning are not among those. Memories of my mama, excellent. Wasn't a perfect person any more than any of us here in this building are, but she tried hard, folks. And you'll never convince God that trying doesn't count. And she didn't fail in the obvious ways that anybody looking on would observe. It was just that she was human like the rest of us were, like all of us are. But she was always there. When we were kids, she stayed home, and milked the cows and saw to it that we fed the children, helped with the milking and taking care of the garden, and the produce and canning and all the stuff that moms did back during her day and age, and put up with all the children that were running around underfoot. She did that until we got bigger and the needs of the family were so great that a job at Garrison Furniture Factory with Daddy and what little money milking at the farm produced couldn't supply our needs. And so she did correspondence work and a bunch of other things to qualify herself to begin teaching. And so she started teaching and did that, of course, until the time of her retirement, and enjoyed that a great deal. And she was a good teacher. She taught English. She worked hard at her children to make sure we spoke it. And for the most part, her kids speak English today. Remember the many times that she corrected improper English and all of that around our house. When it came time to cut the apron strings, she wasn't one of those clingy, hold on to you forever and don't leave my nest people. It was okay to cut them. She trusted her children to make decisions and to put up without much interference from her when the decisions that we made maybe weren't the best ones that we could have made. She gave us the time to do things poorly before expecting us to do those things well. She recommended stuff, I mean, she was heavy into reading and things like that. And during boring summers, before I was old enough to get a real job, and just worked around the house and stuff like that, she recommended books for me to read, and when I was proclaiming my boredom and it wasn't time for football or basketball practice or anything like that, and She said, "Well, Larry, you haven't read anything by Steinbeck, have you?" And I said, "Stein who, you know?" And she said, "I've got some books here from my college days. Just, you know, sit down and read these." And so, Grapes of Wrath. I read that book and I thought, gracious, Mama gave me that book to read. If you haven't read it, you don't know what I'm talking about. But there was language in that book that it never was used around our house, folks. I mean, it just wasn't used. So I read The Grapes of Wrath and learned that not everybody lived like our family did. I read The Catcher in the Rye. I read Of Mice and Men. I read from Pearl S. Buck, a book that Mama gave me called The Good Earth, and learned to understand that halfway around the world in China, around the turn of the last century, life was very different than ours, and helped to develop within me an appreciation for all that we have here in this land. But all of that kind of stuff, recommending a school and that I go to it, recommending her faith. Well, we have memories of our mamas and our daddies. I don't know what your mother would have wanted if she were still here, or what she did want if she is here. But for Christian mothers, I know this, and it's true for Christian fathers. Let the other stuff go. Forget about any Christmas gift. Forget about a birthday gift. All of those kinds of things, just let them all go. And she would be content if you would just give her the assurance that everything is okay with you. If she could rest comfortably in the knowledge that you're okay with the Lord now, and it is your intention that you will be okay with the Lord in the future. That's all any Christian parent ever really wants. I don't know of any heart that can rejoice for their children any better than a mother's heart, and I don't know of any heart that can break any harder for their children than a mother's heart. I like Norman Rockwell's paintings. Those that used to appear on the cover of Life and Look magazine, if you recall, and you find those in antique stores right now. And they depict a way of life that, if it was ever real, I don't know, but it was what we would like to have been real for families. But we raise our children in a very real world that is full of all kinds of hurts and dangers and threats. We just want them to be okay. And maybe your children aren't. What do we say to one another when the greatest pain that a parent can experience is the pain that you're called upon to endure? We don't know what to say. I don't. Unless we just do what we've done here in 2 Chronicles, and that is to remind each other of the fact that God knows how much you care, and that God ultimately is in control, working today on your behalf and your family's behalf, guiding events and circumstances, and bringing to the front those that bear upon getting that child where both you and God would have him to be. He works in ways that are immediately obvious to us, and he works in ways that may not ever be obvious to us as we live here in this world. It may take eternity for us to really see how he was working. We have mothers here at all different stages, from little bitty children to kids that have been grown and on their own for a long, long time. But that doesn't matter. Where in that range you fall, because you never quit being a mother. So let's tell a story this morning in the few minutes before I sit down. And the story, let's let this story be about a woman and not about a man. Her name is Hadassah. And you may not know her by that name because she had another name. Hadassah was her Hebrew name. It was the name that her mama and daddy gave her. But she was in captivity, I guess you could call it that, as all the Jewish people were under the authority of the Persians, who had destroyed the Medes and Persians, who had destroyed the Babylonians. And she wasn't living in Jerusalem. She was living in Shushan, the capital of the Persian Empire. Her name was Hadassah, but the Persians did what the Babylonians did among captive people. They renamed them. And she was renamed Esther. And there's a book in the Bible that bears her name, and I think most of you are probably very familiar with the story. Let me just hit a couple of the high points. She was a Jew. She lived in the palace of the king of Persia. His name was Ahasuerus. And that wasn't really his name. That was the Hebrew equivalent of his Persian name. He had a name that was strung together in the Persian language of a bunch of consonants that couldn't be pronounced in either the Hebrew, the Greek, or the English. And so among the Hebrew, it turned out Ahasuerus. The Greeks, when they translated his name into the Greek language, it turned out Xerxes. If you read about him in your world history books, you'll read about him under the name Xerxes. If you read about him in the Bible, you will read about him under the name Ahasuerus. Same guy. Esther was his queen. And she was his queen by way of circumstance, because she was the prettiest girl in the land. You know, when the contest was held, bar none, she was the prettiest. Vashti, who had been the queen, refused to appear in public for the honor of her husband so that other rulers could gawk at her, and she wouldn't come out and do that. And so the king had set her aside and had now selected Esther. Esther was an orphaned Jewish girl. She had been raised by an older cousin by the name of Mordecai. Esther chapter 4. Mordecai verse 13 commanded to Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed, and who knoweth whither thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" He asked her a question that she ultimately would have to answer that would affect not only her destiny, but the destiny of the entire nation of Israel, because they were about to be destroyed on the 13th day of the 12th month, 11 months from this time. The nation of Israel in all 127 provinces of the Persian Empire, all the rulers of those provinces had received the decree from King Ahasuerus to go out on that day and destroy man, woman, and child of Jewish heritage, so that in that one day every Jew would die. And that was done because of Mordecai. Because Mordecai had refused to bow when Ahasuerus's number two man, a guy by the name of Haman, who was really powerful, folks, number two in that kingdom that spread all the way through all of Europe and down into Africa, all the way over to the edge of China, including all of India and all of that Middle Eastern area, Iran and Iraq and Turkey. And he was the number two guy, and when he would walk by, Mordecai would not bow. Everybody else bowed, but Mordecai explained, "I'm a Jew." He didn't bow. And Haman became offended. And Haman visited the king and said, "Here's the deal." And the king said, "What do you want to do?" And Haman said, "I want to kill them all. Every last one. It is an affront to you, the king, who has ordered all people to bow before me. And it is an affront to me personally." And so the king signed the decree. He put his ring to the decree, and it was a done deal. And you know the book. Nothing could change that. Once the king put his signet to the law, it was a law that was not revocable. The king himself couldn't change it. And so the date had been set, and Mordecai's challenge to Esther was, "You got to go see the king." Now, Esther was one of many wives. Understand that. She didn't live in the same section of the palace. She had her own private section of the palace, and nobody went to see the king unless the king called for them. And Esther said to Mordecai, "I said, yeah, I know, but he hasn't called for me in 30 days. And I don't know when he'll call for me again." And Mordecai said, "You've got to go see him." The problem with that was that if you went to see the king of Persia during that time, without a scheduled appointment, without him asking you to come, and you just walked in, the guards at the entrance to where his throne room was would kill you. That was just it. Nobody walked in unannounced and unprepared for it. Those guards had no duty other than to kill people who might presume to do that. But Esther said, okay, I'll go. And so she did. And she didn't know exactly how that would be received and whether she would live or die. But she went and she opened the door. And when she opened the door, the king looked up from across the throne room and saw her entering and immediately raised his scepter or his staff. Now, if the king did that, the guards who were reaching for their swords would stop. And so he raised his scepter, which meant she could come on in. And so she did. And the king asked her, what can I give you? You know, I mean, she was a beautiful lady, up to half my kingdom. He said, you just name it and I'll do it. But she was scared and intimidated and didn't know what to ask for. So she said, you and Haman come and eat at my place tonight. And so they did. And the king said, now listen, when he got there, said, you're wanting something beyond us coming for a meal. And she said, thought about it, and she said, well, really, I had a big meal planned tomorrow evening. I'd really like for you to come back then. And so they said, well, we'll be there, you know. And she just couldn't quite get around to get the gumption to ask the right question. Well, Haman, of course, was working behind scenes to still get at Mordecai, who still wasn't bowing. He complained to his wife, and his wife said, well, why don't you hang the man? Now, why don't you just kill him? You can get to the rest of the Jews later, but kill him now. He's a thorn in your side. And so Haman, that very night, called in the carpenters, and they built gallows 75 foot high so that the next morning he could go to Ahasuerus and let him know the plan that Mordecai was going to die on those gallows. You see, Mordecai was known to the king. He was an official at the gate, a lesser official than Haman, but he was, you know, a man well known to the king. And so Haman had come with that intention to ask for the life of Mordecai. But on that next feast, the king insisted, you got to tell me what's on your mind. Sweetie said, if you don't let me know, how can I give you what you're asking for? So she told him the business about Haman, and that Haman, when killing all the Jews, would kill her because she was a Jew. Oh, he didn't know that. And Mordecai would die. And Mordecai was a Jew who had saved the king's life because there had been a plot by a couple of his chamberlains to come in and murder King Ahasuerus. Well, it all worked out this way. It all worked out that, as you know, it all worked out that Ahasuerus, when he heard that that was really the motivation behind what Haman was doing, thought about it again and said, hey, I can't undo what's already been done. What can I do to help you? He said, I can do this. And he commanded his soldiers to take Haman and hang him on his own gallows. And they did. The number two slot was now open. He promoted Mordecai to the number two slot in all the Persian Empire. But the law was still in force that on the 13th day of the 12th month, everybody would die. And the king said, here, all I can do is tell you this. Take my ring. Write whatever you need to write that will equip your people to deal with what's facing them. And so they took and they wrote and they signed it with the king's signet, giving the Jews, all the Jews throughout all 127 provinces, permission to take swords and weapons, whatever they needed to do to defend themselves that day, because the decree lasted only for 24 hours that the Jews could be destroyed. And so they did that. And when that day came, the Jews were well prepared. And all of the soldiers and others that fell upon them were fallen upon by the Jews, and there was a great victory given to them by God. So much so that before the book of Esther concludes, it says, a lot of those people became Jews because they could see in such a mighty way what had been done. The divine providence of God, working through Esther, a book that doesn't even mention God, a book that doesn't mention prayer, a book that doesn't contain any specific religious teaching, a book where anyone has to grope to find God in it. But you see, that book is, it's a lot like our lives. Sometimes we grope looking for God. I promise you this, if you'll look, you'll find Him. In a series of interlocking events that have occurred through the course of your lifetime to bring you to wherever you are at this point, because here you sit in this assembly. And don't you dare think that God had nothing to do with this. this. He's had everything to do with this. Be mindful, mothers, dads, church members, that God is aware of our circumstances and that He shows Himself strong in behalf of His people because He cares for us. We're going to sing a song of invitation. If you're here and not a Christian, this is your opportunity to come this morning in repentance of sin and confession of your faith. We will baptize you into Christ, which is the will of God for your life. Or if you need our prayers as God's child, we stand ready to assist. We'll sing the first and last stanza. You come while we stand and sing.